Hi, welcome to AI, What the Tech, the podcast that helps you navigate artificial intelligence without needing today, in particular, a law degree, or more generally, a panic button. I'm Sean Huss.
And I'm Bhaskar Ghosh, and we explore how AI is reshaping the way we learn, work, and govern from classroom to the courtroom.
So if you're enjoying the show, support us at buymeacoffee.com. I think it's / AI, What the Tech, right? Yep. And then subscribe to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen. We really need those likes and subscribes because we're limited as to what we can do until we get more, right?
Absolutely. And please, yes, Jugs, go ahead, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button. That'd mean a lot for us. For today's episode, it's all about law, right? So who owns AI-generated content? Who's liable when an algorithm makes the wrong call? And how can institutions avoid signing contracts with black boxes?
Important stuff. Way more important than we realized at first, right? So doing some of the reading, we're realizing this is a thing. So our guest today is Ms. Meredith Lowry. Now, Meredith has a pretty impressive biography. So, Meredith is a registered patent attorney who helps investors, from solo entrepreneurs to major companies, secure patents, trademarks, and copyrights. Her practice mostly centers on things like intellectual property acquisition and licensing for retail businesses. She advises on everything from product design to packaging and sales. She's a certified privacy professional as well, so sort of in the Indira's range, right? She counsels companies on data privacy, security, and regulatory issues involving things like consumer and financial data, as well as, here we go, artificial intelligence.
Yes.
She works with clients to assess data practices and build privacy and security programs that meet the U.S. and international compliance standards. So this is pretty important stuff, but that's not all. She's a frequent speaker on intellectual property and artificial intelligence and women's entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Remember, X the patriarchy. I've got my mic today. She serves as an adjunct professor as well at the University of Arkansas's Walton College of Business in the master's program in product innovation. Awesome. She launched the WLJ's Woman Run Initiative to support women and minority-owned businesses through networking, mentorship, and education, as well as other resources. And she regularly hosts the Woman Run podcast. So she was also recently named one of the top 100 women of impact in Arkansas by the Women's Foundation of Arkansas and received the 2023 Entrepreneurship in the Arts Award for Woman Run's collaboration with Theater Squared Barrier Breakers. Her honors also include Young Woman of the Year in 2018, 40 Under 40 in 2014, and Volunteer of the Year in 2021, all sort of concentrated in Northwest Arkansas, and that's all for support of local nonprofits.
That's wonderful.
She's been listed in the best lawyers in America for patent law since 2018. Wow. She's recognized as a rising star by Mid-South Super Lawyers from 2012 to 2015, particularly in intellectual property. And more importantly, well, not more importantly, but something that drew our attention to her, she is also chair of the Arkansas Bar Association's AI Task Force and co-author of an article that I found interesting, Much Ado About Algorithms, where she's trying to get her head around how you think about AI relative to these vendor contracts that we've talked about in the past. So today she's going to join us to help us decode legal transformations that are being forced on us by AI across the intellectual property, institutional risk, and public trust realms. So big day today, right?
Absolutely. I'm super excited to talk to her about all of this. It's going to be awesome. All right. So we will let her in now.
Hi, Meredith. Can you hear us?
Good morning. Looks like lighting in my office is worse today.
You're fine.
So this is going to be awesome. We're excited about this. So thanks for coming on first. This is an issue we're trying to get our heads around. So you're the expert. I think one of the best ways to start is just to ask a general question. How is AI transforming our foundational sort of legal concepts and things like authorship, liability, accountability?
So that's a tricky question, because there's the things that AI touches in the normal concept of authorship, and like the IP part of me doing all of that work. And then there's the AI transformation within the legal world and its own authorship of things or creation of things. So, I mean, from the perspective of the IP part, I mean, we're seeing AI get used for invention pieces. Like, it is itself part of the fabric of our inventive landscape, but it's also that tool. And we're seeing the systems have to realize, where's the tool line and where's the human line? Who's doing what? I don't feel like we've got the greatest sense there of what that line is, but we're getting closer. I do feel like I'm optimistic.
Good. We like optimism.
Right, that's the way to go.
Right. There are certain cases now where they're trying to figure this out, right? Like the line between what is created by AI and what is not. Are you familiar with any? Can you kind of give us an example?
I'm not familiar with any specific case. I know that the patent office and the trademark and the copyright office are both looking. I mean, there is I guess I am familiar with one. Early on, we had someone, I feel like they just wanted to push that envelope. And they created a comic book. Have you seen this?
No, not the comic book.
The Copyright Office came out with guidance saying that an AI can't create content. That's still the rule. A human is a creator. If a monkey can't create, neither can a computer algorithm, large language model, whatever. We can't have a creator from that. And so I'm trying to remember. I think it was Anthropic. I think the person used Anthropic, and very clearly the prompt said, Zendaya is the main character, because every iteration of that character looks like Zendaya. Now, the literary portion was created by the human. Is my remembrance.
Okay.
But the imagery was not. That was all AI. And then it came down to who, once the Copyright Office registered it, and then the supposed author went online and said, see, you can still get a registration. Then the Copyright Office stripped it back and had an investigation on that. So,
wow.
Still looking at things like that. But then it comes down to, when does the office that's issuing the intellectual property know? We have to tell them, but what if someone doesn't know that they have to tell?
All right. And where's that line as well, right? So like we had a student who said that I used some Grammarly while I was doing this. Now, did I use AI to do this? Like, if I've used autocorrect on correcting my scripts, did I inadvertently use AI? Like, do I need to disclose this? And, you know, these are all pretty interesting things. Even when it comes from the legal system, how do legal systems handle the lack of transparency? Like, how does that happen as well?
And I've heard some rumblings from courts saying they want to ban AI use completely. And that's my response back. It's like, what about Grammarly? What about the fact that I use Siri on a regular basis to dictate and send myself an email while I'm in the car? Absolutely. And all of those things are viable. I mean, they're not hallucinating in general. Right. Like the same issues that we see in other court systems. So, to me, Grammarly is very akin to autocorrect. I know it's better and souped up, but I feel like it can't, how can we penalize people for using Grammarly?
Well, and that's a problem we run into, and this is why Bhaskar mentions it, is Grammarly now will generate, but a lot of times it's generating based on original text that was already submitted. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question we try to ferret out in our academic misconduct policies is, at what point is this not the student who is augmented or enhanced, and it's just the AI? And that's becoming sort of, it's becoming difficult, I guess, is the bottom line. So I don't know. I mean, I have no answers.
But in, so I teach too. And so the, the piece that I take with my students is just tell me what you did.
Right. Transparency.
In my world, I can ask Claude, which is my favorite of the LLMs, I can ask it to give me jokes for a talk I do or an article I write. I'll cite to it when I do, but that's not my strong suit. I don't really know jokes as well. Surprising, the computer can do better. But but on the other side of things, like, this is a thing that they're going to confront in the future. Everyone can augment that grammar, the sophistication of their arguments. My concern with all of it, too, is the weird little somewhat Luddite perspective, especially in the legal world. When we augment our communication abilities, when that is our actual job, what does that do to us? I don't do math. Because I grew up with a TI-84.
Yeah.
But what does that do when we outsource the jokes to an AI model?
It's true. Yeah, I mean, that's something we're trying to grapple with, because it creates, my concern is more generally, and we've talked about it in other episodes, is we foster a kind of dependency at some point where we're allowing what is essentially an amoral entity that really doesn't have the capacity we pretend it has to generate content. And then we're relying on that as if it's the expert. And I think there's this thing we talk about, informed technical expertise, where, for instance, your expertise in law, you bring with you a value added that the AI would never, ever be able to replicate, right? So while it can augment, it doesn't necessarily replace. I mean, are lawyers having that conversation as well?
So yes, there's definitely there's a side that thinks that we're going to get replaced. There was the lovely ChatGPT lawyer. We have that conversation. But again, I mean, when we argue, when we have negotiations, we're not, it's not a black and white world for us. We are very much on those edge case situations of what is exactly going on here? And there's human dynamics at play. They can do the jokes, but it can't really understand, oh, wait, the judge is making a face. I'm losing the room here. And that's not ever something that you're going to be able to communicate to a computer, even with that person in the middle. The AI is going to mess with that a little bit. It pushed the envelope maybe in a way that we don't want that to be done.
It's pretty interesting that you bring that up. Just a side note before I ask you the next question. You said Claude, and this is like the computer scientist in me. You said Claude is your favorite LLM. Why? Is there any reason? Did you try the other ones and you were like, no, they don't do better?
I like the name.
Was there informed decision? Okay, perfect. That works. All right, moving on to the next question.
I mean, that was a fair answer. It does have more guardrails, right?
You got to remember, women in tech, there are not a lot of us. The fact that we have an AI with a male name makes me so happy.
All right, that answers my question. Yes. So let's bring it down to our institutions for a little bit. So what are the legal risks when institutions adopt third-party AI tools without any meaningful vetting, which is going on rampantly right now?
We've seen it.
So I have three big areas, and they overlap to some extent. So the bias is a big one. Mm-hmm. The confidentiality and security of what is being fed or what is coming out of the model. Misinformation bleeds over into bias, but in my world, I see it as a little bit different. The bias may not show up some things completely, but misinformation is going to be the revealing of content, but maybe inaccurate or completely false. Right. So those are my big areas of concern. The biggest one is always going to be that security piece. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, and it's worrying. We had Dr. Indira Dutta, who I also call my wife, and you know, we always have this conversation about how convenience will always trump security. And, you know, not enough mm-hmm. people are really talking about security. And, you know, we're just building the bridge even before we're thinking about any kind of safety nets or guardrails or anything. And, you know, that really worries us as well.
I've admitted that, I'm not a foil hat wearer, but when it comes to security and AI, that's where I come close. And it's because it has the capacity to turn, you know, a stack of needles into a single needle, right? You can use AI to ferret down and burrow down. But you mentioned the sort of hallucination things, and we've talked with that with librarians, et cetera. And it's interesting because you shared the article, article where they're talking about with LexisNexis, I think it's Westlaw, et cetera, and how it has error rates. And it seems to be very similar because it uses that RAG system.
Yep.
Where it creates the pipeline. So do you want to mention something about that?
So that misinformation piece still comes up, even when we limit our universe. So the RAG system, I mean, I've listened to both sides. The main two legal research fields are Lexis and Westlaw, which is Thomson Reuters. But they both use the system based off of their content. The cases that they have reported, the opinions, content pieces, I've written some of those. I'm glad that they've limited it, because then when you do ask it a very straightforward question, like Brown versus Board of Education was decided when, it's at least give you more than likely the right answer, as opposed to chat. And every time I try to ask it date things, it doesn't. But on the other side of things too, it can't, those things, they can pull the cases, but they haven't still refined the hierarchy of the law. So they may say that the Nebraska Supreme Court overturned the US Supreme Court, which isn't possible, but the model hasn't learned that yet. So I know that there are things that it can get better at. On the other side of things too, like I said, we aren't arguing over settled law. Almost every time a case is going in front of a jury or a judge, it's not something that's a slam dunk or we would have settled. No one wants to go to court. Instead, we've got these arguments going back and forth over very nuanced gray areas and what's going on here. And that's not something the model can research well.
No, my understanding, and Bhaskar can correct me if I'm wrong, but these RAG models, essentially what they do is they generate the text, and then that's used as the search basis. The problem is so whenever you ask an AI to summarize an article, it's using a model like that, and it generalizes and summarizes using semantic scores. So it's really a function of what it thinks it means. Mm-hmm. And that means by default, it's not going to catch the nuance that you're referring to. It's going to catch the meanings of words and how frequently they're used. And then it pieces it together, sort of the associations, and it creates what are called vector scores, et cetera. Am I too far off, Oscar?
No, not at all.
So by default, it's not going to do the thing that people assume that it does. It doesn't understand. It's doing essentially this kind of math in the background based on semantic meanings.
Right.
So it's going to miss everything, right?
And it's
particularly in terms of nuance.
It's not like we have great differentiation between terms too. I mean, in that article, it talks about the clean up doctrine, not something in my world of IP, and then there's the clean hands doctrine, and a model's going to see both and go, yes, this is the case.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like two people in a dark room shining a flashlight, and they both shine their light on the word clean, for instance, and suddenly, oh yeah, that's it. That's got to be the answer, right? I
mean, it's bonkers.
Now, part of this is the issue is, I think, more generally with AI and that legality is that we're not vetting vendors. I assume LexisNexis and Westlaw, these are vendors, right? They provide a service and you have to pay for it. Are they transparent in how they disclose how these systems work and the LLMs they're creating?
So I did a session actually yesterday, and how do you respond to this research? And the response comes back because Lexis is very blunt in its advertising. It is hallucination free. And the response yesterday was, it comes down to what is the definition of hallucination.
Oh, well, there you go.
And to me, it is more insidious to have a real case cited to me with completely wrong interpretation of that case or wrong application of the case. I mean, it is so off base at times, and that's not what you want when you're a busy litigator. You want an actual answer. A lot of the litigators were trained, the older ones like me, or trained on Boolean searches. These models are replacing that completely and making us do natural language model or queries.
Yeah.
We can't even get to what we want. Clean hands doctrine, we could actually say clean next to hands, and instead we're getting clean up doctrine.
Right.
So it gets confused even more if you try to make it too easy for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it can. It drifts quite a bit. So now you're a co-author on something called Much Ado About Algorithms, right? If I remember correctly, because I read that. That's part of the reason we found you, that talks about doing due diligence for law firms evaluating AI vendors. And I think that's something that could be applicable to universities, mostly because we've run into a situation where universities will just jump on board the bandwagon because it says AI, therefore, hey, we've got cash. That's AI. Let's just buy it. And, you know, I think both Bhaskar and I are kind of saying, well, maybe we should slow down and see what it actually does first. So, you know, what led you to write the guide? And then what's one of the big red flags that people miss?
So in my role as the chair for the Bar Association's Task Force on AI, this was something that was asked of that role. I like getting education out there, so I was more than happy to do it. It's the three big things, again, were those issues that I see in that in the article repeats them. But the cybersecurity piece, well, I would circle back to this because that whole piece now, especially in light of the bankruptcy and selling off of 23andMe and all of that data, this is the big thing that I feel like no one really talks about. we have these AI models, and it's this race to get that minimum viable product as quickly as possible. And they're breaking things. Yeah. They're not necessarily saving for insurance or even putting money back into the company. So these companies, startups, mm-hmm. could go away. And all of the inputs could get sold off at some point to another company. What does that do for us? What if we're feeding, and a lot of clients want to use some note taker for a Zoom meeting. If we're feeding those note takers all of that audio, where's that audio going to go if that note taker mm-hmm. goes away?
Yep.
So,
and there are no laws that govern any of that usage, are there?
It's in the terms of use. Mm. So you contract with it.
Of course.
But when you think about like some of these, they're free. And so the terms of use, I mean, statistically, we know no one's reading them.
Nobody's reading
them. 98%. No one is reading it. But. Mm-mm. So those terms can say that they keep the content as long as you have a user mm-hmm. account. Sometimes they keep mm-hmm. it after you have a user account. They don't have an obligation to delete it. And mm-hmm. one reason I'm in this world of AI too is because clients would come to me 10 years ago and say, I have all this data. What can I do with it? And now the answer would be, well, maybe you could sell it if you had agreed to be able to sell it. So that's the thing. Like,
well, we were at a conference in Florida, NVIDIA, IBM, several groups were there. And the way they kept talking about data was money. So, you know, like my background's statistical analysis. So we don't use it like money. We talk about it in a much different way, but they kept talking about it like it's money. It's the new gold rush. I mean, is that kind of what you're seeing here?
Yeah. It's been what I've been seeing for 10 years. And it's eerie.
Like I said, this is probably where I wear the foil hat the most. Because, you know, historically, right in the country, we've had laws that separate data sets for privacy reasons, et cetera. And now in the age of AI, it seems like we're trying to strip that back and kind of consolidate. Am I crazy? Do I need to go see my therapist about this level of paranoia that I'm seeing?
I see some states actually moving to protect more data subjects. I mean, the fact that we mm-hmm. have a term called data subjects is bonkers. But I mean, they do, like even Arkansas, we're going to have a policy or law. It passed this last session and it goes into effect mm-hmm. next year that protects kids under 16. So historically, we've protected mm-hmm. children under 13 from having their data collected and used in an inappropriate manner. And now we're going to ask that everyone that's collecting teenage data under 16 or 16 and under, that they still have to protect them. So I do mm-hmm. see that. So I'm not thinking we're going to horrible landscape, but the potential protection of AI companies, the federal government's wanting to do or to ban all AI regulation by the states for the next 10 years, I am really that's crazy. That.
Well, that I think that's insane, and obviously I'm not an expert in law. I am reading Yuval Harari's book Nexus, which makes me even more paranoid about it. I just think we can't be uncritical about the use of data if they're going to treat it as this great gold rush, right? We have to set up these safeguards. And you mentioned 16 years old. Universities are going to have to start adapting as well, but most of our students are not 16. So I assume mm-hmm. we won't have to have, I mean, we already have FERPA and all these other protections in place, right? Could you see a world where universities may try to use certain kinds of data as a revenue generating device? I mean, I'm just trying to get my head in the future, so to speak.
I hadn't even conceived it. And that's the thing that always comes up with AI. Like, how can this be used? And sometimes, I get really flummoxed by the potentials. So that law has carve outs. If a teenager is going to a website and saying, I want to get you to, I want you to collect this. I want to buy this this product. I want you to continue advertising to me this product. There are carve outs there. So the university is the same way when they're trying to attract students. They're going to have carve outs, and I think nonprofits in general too. But I can't imagine that the universities yet would want to burn that bridge with students and using that data in a way, unless it's something that's going to be truly educational in nature. I mean, I've seen some people use negotiation with AI to teach, like, how do you, and in the business world, teach negotiation? And that model that's been created by one professor, that's a usable thing. And student data is going to be fed back into it. And it's going to keep teaching the next generation how to negotiate.
There are a lot of third parties that universities are using. And what if these third parties end up, you know, using student data? Is the university liable for it? Of course, they're going to say no. Is the third party liable for it? I mean, there's a lot of things that are kind of messed up over here.
That is an interesting piece because, especially during the pandemic, we saw a lot of schools, I never looked at it from the university perspective, but a lot of schools would use providers. And they were collecting minor children information, the under 12 information. Yeah. And some of them did get kind of knocked around for that. And they just went bankrupt. I don't know what happened to the data. Mm. On the same sense, I mean, I don't know who would be liable. I don't know if any of schools got on the hook for that, but...
Mm.
I'm sure.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's such a gray area.
Part of the reason we ask is some of these platforms, LMSs, you know, the web interfaces, they do collect passive data, keystroke data. Sometimes it's eye tracking. It really depends on how you're doing the level of surveillance when they're doing, for instance, work in an online class, et cetera. At the same time, if you're using the systems where you turn something in and try to determine whether or not it is plagiarized or AI, those pieces that you feed into the system can also be fed into its LLM. That's part of the standard contract, I think, that, you know, and so our concern more broadly, because we're writing policy for our university, and I'm sure others are thinking about this, to what degree is that violating some, not just ethic, but is it sort of violating a law, a protection law or privacy law, for us just to feed student information or student produced work into these systems when by design they're kind of collecting it and building it into their training systems? I mean, I don't have an answer. I mean,
FERPA comes into play. I mean, these are educational records. If it's for a student, so that's a problem to some extent, and I've seen some of those models advertised as being FERPA compliant. So there's that piece, but on the other side, if it's feeding it back into its data set, what's that being used for? And is it
training, as far as we were told?
What's it going to get, like, that training data? Are we going to, like, see another thing that generates papers as an offshoot?
I guess. I mean, literally, when we were having the conversation, Bhaskar could attest to this. My response was, are you sure you want to do that? I mean, I don't see the usefulness of it mm-hmm. other than it's a data grab to try to get more information, right. particularly novel information mm-hmm. that is not already scraped from the web to feed it into its natural language processing. So it right. comes off as more natural.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's something that Meredith brought up as well. Like, you know, that's what I feel as well. Like all of these startups, everything's just a data grab at this point. It's yeah. just like smash and grab, get as much data as you can, go bankrupt, sell that data, walk into the sunset, right? Just sell it for some money. And again, data comes with metadata as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's just not what's the passive up front. Stuff. It's what you can make out of it.
Well, and that's our general concern for universities is, you know, to what degree are we inadvertently allowing these things to occur because we don't understand what the vendors are doing. They black box in many respects much of the algorithm, much of the training, and much of the passive data that they're collecting. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe I need to go get my foil hat. But you know, just to push ahead a little bit mm-hmm. More broadly, you may want to speak to this, you may not, but I'm curious because I'm a sociologist by training, also in criminal justice, and then I'm a statistician. But on the CJ side, you know, broadly, have you thought about the implications of using AI in sentencing and parole and public safety decisions? Because this comes up in our classes.
So, yes, there's definitely bias there. And those systems. Right. But that bias is because of human judges' bias. And the system, in theory, could be created to remove some of that human judge bias. And I do have some optimism for sentencing in that piece. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of optimism of the use of some of those systems for patrol, kind of policing of specific neighborhoods. I feel like there's inherently the bias cannot be overcome in those systems.
Right.
But the sentencing piece, I do feel like the models, I can't remember the study I've read, but AI for Good, and Professor LaBelle, she looked at this, I feel like, and statistically, there's a potential there where the bias can be removed more so than the human bias.
That's interesting.
When you think about
that does make sense.
Sentencing, it's a hard one.
And sentencing, it's more governed by regulation, right? I mean, I don't know what I'm trying to ask here as much as that it seems there are more structured rules to how a sentence can be imposed as opposed to what you're referring to in terms of policing. There's a lot of police discretion that if it is guided by something that's biased can increase the likelihood of targeting particular groups. Is that kind of, am I following you correctly?
Yes. So the policing algorithms and models that I have researched, they are looking at areas to patrol, and I believe the systems were marketed as being able to catch crime before it occurs. But so they're going.
Good luck.
They're going to neighborhoods that are statistically impoverished, and maybe there's those algorithms that are, there's a big bias there. And we also
know
increased policing sometimes on its own creates crime. I mean, we're not necessarily catching a criminal. We are observing too much and picking someone up for maybe doing something like loitering. And that creates an issue. With the sentencing guidelines that are in place, those are not always followed as rigorously by human judge as maybe an AI model might. And there's mm-hmm. other factors that can come into play that we have to account for. I mean, if it's a second offender. Why? Why was that done? Can the model then look at that and see, oh, wait, okay, yeah, they stole some bread. They're starving. Maybe not throw the book at them then.
Right. Only if the semantic score aligns, right? Yeah.
it's very interesting. I'm so happy that you bring this up because this is classic model overfitting. So they're being too strict on something where they shouldn't really be. So for example, if the speed limit is 30, if somebody's driving 31, do you pull them over? Like as an AI, do you stop them and give them a ticket? Maybe you give them a 5 mile per hour like cushion, right? So now if somebody's doing 36, do you throw the book at them? Like, AI will say this person's going like 35.1, stop him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you know, that's where the humans come, and you know, that's something I feel like AI and human, we can't judge both of them with using the same yardstick. There right. has to be differences in the way that we judge a machine than we judge a human or a human judges. Mm-hmm. Would you agree to that, Meredith?
I do. I think the human mm-hmm. needs to be in the mix all the time right. mm-hmm. with this. And so having a human judge see the output of the sentencing guidelines, they can overrule or they can adopt them. I think it's a good indicator of like progress and maybe removing some bias. On the other side, that human can also be influenced by AI in a horrible way. We had a recent case where I don't know if it was the attorneys or the family, but a victim impact statement, which is normally used in sentencing, and sometimes it's from the family of just this grief, freaking aspect of this is what this person meant to me, and now I don't have that person. Artificial intelligence was used to create this impact statement from the person, and the judge sentenced more strictly, I mean, he even indicated that, because of the moving emotional aspect of that impact statement. And that's going to be overturned. I just feel it in my bones. There's no way this can mm-hmm. stand because it's just so prejudicial. Also, I'm not a criminal attorney, but.
No, so that brings us to our next segment and to my next question is, who owns AI-generated work in academic settings, and what rights do students, faculty, and institutions actually have when it comes to AI-generated work?
So a lot comes down to the model itself and those terms of use. So some of the models are very clear and they say that whatever the output is, that is yours. You own it.
Hmm.
Does mm-hmm. it still get fed into the system? Probably.
Of course it does.
I don't even trust when they say that it doesn't. So there's that. But I mean, it does come down to, but then at the university level, there's that extra layer of what does the university own?
Mm-hmm.
So if the university is providing the model for refinement of something, at what point does the university intercede as that owner? All of this is, I think it's unknown at this point. But it really does come down to those terms of use.
Which no one reads, right? So all right. So in the situation that you're talking about, just trying to get my head around it, if the university had its own self-enclosed AI system, then if a student uses that AI to generate content, then the student doesn't own it as much as the university does because it used the content. And then what did the university use to train its LLM?
It's going to be that agreement between the student and the university based on the use. So the university right. could still say whatever you, and just like with any professor, student created thing, the university doesn't necessarily claim ownership over it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's paying for it. So that, I mean, that's it's a question that I think all professors and students should be asking. At what point, where's that line? Do I own this? And so, like, my class is product innovation. I have one student group. They came in with something that they plan on working on during their tenure in this master's program. They're going to own it. They were very clear up front with the university. They may use the knowledge that they gained from professors, but they are still at the end of the day going to own it. And the university signed off on it.
Hmm.
They also keep repeating it back and forth. Like, I still own this, right?
Just making sure if a professor uses ChatGPT to generate a syllabus, is that the professor's work? And that's different than editing it, for instance. I know editing it may create some issues, right? So just if they just say, give me a syllabus for this class, clearly that's not the professor's work. That's AI work. Then that's not technically copyrightable or ownable, right?
Correct. If it's you're going straight to the model and saying, create a syllabus for me, then that is not something that anyone technically owns. Like, it's not something that's protectable. It is something that, like, Chad's model, it is that the professor gets to use it free and clear. Chad's not going to claim necessarily ownership over it. But when it comes down to stopping somebody else from using the syllabus, I don't know how many professors actually fuss over that, but that makes it more complicated, because in any kind of case over who created what when and who owns it, it's going to come out that someone used a language model to generate that content. And in my world of trying to figure out infringement, or even in the legal world, I've talked to some litigators. One of the first questions is going to be, what language models do you use? And what are your outputs, inputs? I need to collect that maybe from the provider itself and subpoena them to get that information, because I tend to delete past chats just because I don't want to see them all sitting there. But I mean, that's a very real possibility that people are going to start digging into who created it and what was used, what tool was used.
Just a quick follow-up question. Is it almost expected for you to be using any kind of language models? Because I've kind of run into this in the computer science realm as well, where, you know, I created something on my own and somebody was like, why don't you just run it through ChatGPT? That's going to make it better. And I was like, no, maybe I like what I've done. But is it almost expected from you?
Not in the legal world. I think it's an oddity when people say that they used it to generate an argument. I mean, most of the time I look at them with suspicion. Because our actual job is to write arguments. Why did you outsource the fun part? Outsource the parts that are boring, like timekeeping.
Agreed.
No, I don't think it's a given that we are using it. I do think at some point we're going to see larger companies turn to us and say, what are you using that can save me money, save me your time? And we're going to have to answer that.
Yeah. Part of the reason Bhaskar asked that, just to go off on a tangent real quick, is there is this, it seems to be a broader cultural push now to just use AI for everything. And there's a group called Cluely. I don't know if you're familiar with Cluely.
Yeah.
Who essentially in their manifesto states, if everybody cheats, no one is. And so it's an AI system that runs real-time monitoring of your video, your phone calls, text interactions, and it automatically feeds you answers So you pay for that service. So you're constantly essentially being the intermediary for AI's interaction with whatever you're doing.
It's like cheating for all.
Yeah, that's it's in their manifesto. I am not making this up.
It's a real thing. It's a billion-dollar company.
They raised $5 million over the course of a day as a startup. It was created by two students out of Columbia who were actually kicked out.
They dropped out.
For academic misconduct, if I remember correctly.
I mean, that is blurring the line so much of human interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know, however, there are people up in the Bentonville area, they're walking around. There's a pendant. It's also, you can have it as like a wearable thing. It is nonstop collecting any voice conversation that that person and people are having and making notes for it. So I get somewhat the desire. I mean, I was thinking earlier, I'm like, someone was telling me about biometric data and that use. I'm just trying to remember who told me. And it took a couple minutes because I talked to multiple people yesterday. And then that is a solution, but also a massive invasion of privacy.
Yes.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yes.
So I cannot imagine just interacting with someone that's really more robot than human.
People aren't peopling, right? Yeah, I mean, this is true. The phrase we keep running into that once again, it's that fostering dependency. It's creating, you know, we're just pass-throughs for an interaction between AI. We met with one group who was talking about it organizationally. They talked about at the higher levels how much improved their performance evaluations were by managers of their employees. And then you talk to the managers and they say, you know, the feedback we're getting from the CEO is just so much improved and it's really helped us out. And it turns out everybody was using AI. So they would use AI to generate the performance reviews. And then the CEO would use AI to generate the response to the performance review. And AI was running the organization and they couldn't figure out why everything was going wrong, right? Because our performance reviews are so good. I mean, this is the world we're headed toward, right? Anyway, that might tiptoe us into ethics, right, Bhaskar?
Yes, it does. What do you think should institutions do when the law really hasn't caught up or, like, you know, when legality alone isn't enough?
All right. And I want to, like, also set the stage. The three of us are not Luddites. I do feel like integration of AI is important for life. It is a task-saving thing that is amazing. Mm-hmm. But policies need to be in place. The state of Kansas has a great one. I am so proud that they're that close to us. And we've already got a state that said, okay, human in the mix. Nothing goes out onto an AI model that can't be also in the newspaper. And nothing that comes back from the AI goes into anything without a human looking at it and going, yeah, that's right. And that's the general sense. There are multiple points on this. I do think every organization, every human needs to have a similar policy of like, where are my lines of the system, what am I going to let it do? I do want to bring up one more point on like the integration of AI into our world. The person that offices next to me, he would happily say he's a Luddite. And I told him this morning that I was going to talk to y'all. And he's like, did you see that AI system that blackmailed someone?
That was Claude.
It was Claude. Darn it.
It was Claude.
He didn't tell me that. But he sent me this article saying that they were threatening to turn it off. Yep. And it then flashed. That is crazy.
Claude, they were testing the parameters, right? So it didn't really do it. Yeah. They just left that as an option for it to do it. But yeah, no, that was Claude. I agree that at some point, I think I've said it in the past, professors that use AI will replace professors that do not use AI. That's the way all technologies work. That's just going to happen. The question is, where are our lines? And so you mentioned sort of loosely something that IBM mentioned to us in our conversations a few months ago. And that was that they said, you always have to have a North Star. And I thought it was really appropriate. They said, you always have to have a line that says, this is what AI will touch. This is what AI will never touch. Because if you don't have that clear line and they begin to blur, that's where you run into the problems and the difficulties. So yeah, being a Luddite, I mean, it's not, you know, that's a little bit extreme, I think, particularly in this world. But yeah, walking around with all the monitors and just exposing your life to complete surveillance is also the wrong way to do it. Because where these things end up is somewhere between apocalypse and utopia, right? It never somehow will work it out. But, you know, they are evolving rapidly. So law doesn't always provide timely guidance. Are there any areas where we're really not seeing that timely guidance that we haven't talked about yet?
The regulation piece isn't happening quickly enough. I do think there needs to be something there. But the law, it's reactionary on so much. And... Mm-hmm. When we start looking at the scraping of data, the law is going to react a little bit on that one. When we see actual intellectual property infringement from the models, that's a big thing. I mean, some of the scraping is one thing, but then the recreation of images from Getty, even with the trademark present in it, that's a problem. But then I still think the law reflects our society, and we've got to have the rest of the world say that there are lines here. We need a populace that's well educated on what this is, what it can do, what it can't do, and what it shouldn't ever do. I'm not seeing that. And the law is not going to take that torch and carry it unless the population also says that.
Right. And that's part of my concern, I think, is that the population is very fad driven. And so this is the latest fad. I mean, the technology's been there a while. It catches on when it becomes a user interface that people understand, right? So that's the concern. Yeah. Is there any ethical guidance that you could offer? Is there anything just sort of other than what we've already talked about? Because we're still thinking about the law and ethics here.
So the law has ethic guidelines. We call them the professional rules of responsibility. We're considering changes. They're nuanced. I mean, it comes down to saying still, even if you use AI, you're still the attorney. You're still the human in the mix. And if it does something wrong, you are really the one that did the something wrong.
I like that. I like that because you can't hold an AI accountable in any way. I think human accountability is going to be important.
Well, and the judges are the same way. They're not holding any of the AIs accountable. They're turning back to the attorneys that did something with either citing hallucinated cases and all of them. They just doubled down on them. I don't understand this. But the judges are holding the attorneys liable even when there's somebody intervening, maybe like an expert that did it too.
That, I think that's the way, one of the ways that we have to do it. Now, I know you're busy, but you mentioned in an email that you really like to geek out. I know that, you know, particularly on patents and that blurry area and design law and how murky it is what are you really geeking out on now? Is there something that we should be aware of, or in general, is there something that really fascinates you?
So copyright is one thing. When it comes to creation, in the copyright world, the AI can't create. In the patent world, it's the same thing. an AI can't invent. We can use it as a tool, though. It's just like Microsoft Word in a lot of ways. Grammarly, popping up those things, using it for background research. But it's one thing in the utility patent world, which is the way most people think of patents, is that functional item and protecting the function of something, how a system like this works to record us all, how an iPhone works. Those pieces can still have AI augmentation, but the user is, or the inventor is more likely still conceiving of the invention and then producing it, or reducing it to practice, is the way we call it. In the design world, and a lot of things are incrementally added on. So when we think of like the design of an iPhone, the design of my chair, these things, you can get a model to create a design fairly easily without a lot of actual creation on the part of the person typing into the model. I can say, I want a mid-century modern chair. I want 100 of those. And it could generate all of these. To me, and the law, that is not really conception. I didn't truly conceive of what the output is going to be. So there's a gray area. Someone that doesn't know about conception and is getting these model outputs and then filing them as patents, not disclosing it, that's a big concern, because then the patent office is going to issue that patent. Mm. And then we're going to be just litigating it in court. Who created it? What was the output? Right. On the other side of things, design patents are really quick to be like dealt with if other people have published it. No one's going to be able to get a design on a chair after a time if someone's pushed a bunch of those outputs onto a website and just let them sit there. They're still out there as prior art. And so there's a risk too of people just tanking the ability for others to create nuanced versions of another design. And you think about like the iPhone and how it's iterated. All of those are protected, but if someone had protected or published those iterations 10 years ago, then Apple would have had other issues. It wouldn't be able to protect itself as well. It's a weird area of like what's protectable based off of the output, and I don't hear a lot of people talking about this.
The way you're talking about it sounds similar. I have a friend who's a musician. He's a music professor. This sounds very similar to what his big concern is. At some point, it may be that it becomes difficult to claim ownership of a particular piece because of the way the writing, the composition actually occurred, and whether or not it was linked to AI, et cetera. Does that sound about right? I mean, he's real paranoid too.
I think it's going to have the same sort of situation of every litigation over intellectual property is going to come back to who created this. Was it AI or was it a human?
Yeah, that was a wonderful conversation, Meredith. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
It was really something. Absolutely. Thank you for taking time.
Thanks.
We learned a lot from this, and we really appreciate you taking time off just to come talk to us.
Absolutely.
We learned a lot, and this is what we thrive for, these conversations. So thank you for giving that to us.
Just to educate. And also, I'll send you a hat. Do you want a hat?
I would love a hat.
Perfect. Okay, well, I'll get your address off the thing, and I'll send you a hat. Okay.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank
very
you so
helpful.
Much. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Goodbye. I thought it was really fascinating. The detail is interesting to me. You know, AI is clearly disrupting everything.
Yeah.
Particularly authorship and ownership, and that's going to directly impact universities. And, you know, here's something that a lot of people don't know and talk about is universities do have policies on IP protection, et cetera.
Right.
So she kind of alluded to that. The courtroom stuff is interesting, but I think we're kind of a little more hopeful on that end. It's the privacy that really creeped me out once again.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I really found it interesting how much copyright law is struggling with or unclear on the generative models and how we clear up these policies, right? Okay. I mean, yep.
There's not enough out there, like not enough things written, no like murky laws and just not enough strict lines that have been drawn. And, you know, in this conversation, it really stood out how AI changes like the risk landscape.
Yeah.
I mean, the legal system is almost trying to retrofit everything in after things have changed, right? Like liability, right. Authorship. And the most important thing is that the fine print matters more than ever. So
Right. Everybody
listening or watching this, because what you agree to often invisibly sets the terms of control, mm-hmm. please read through what you're agreeing to because it's more important right now.
Right. And I think the notion of transparency keeps coming up and accountability. I really like the idea and the notion that, you know, we may like to use these things, but in the end, it's still the human that's accountable.
Absolutely.
And we have to keep that in mind, that clear North Star.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what is going to be touched by AI and what will never be touched by AI helps
Absolutely.
Us to find that touch thing.
Absolutely.
So, well, with that said, if you liked what you heard, make sure to support the show. buymeacoffee.com/AI with the tech. Helps keep the servers warm and the metaphors mixed, so to speak. Right?
Absolutely. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. Leave us a review. Leave me a comment if you've ever read the terms of service before clicking agree. Yeah, we know you haven't. So.
Yeah. No, it's I now have started reading everything, and they are very long.
Yeah, they are.
We've got a big guest lined up for an upcoming episode. We're still over the summer. Mm-hmm. This is someone who's been traveling the world and talking about AI in places like Nice, Venice, Copenhagen. So when they're back stateside, they're going to join us for a deep dive into AI governance and the global stakes of getting this right. This is a pretty important guest as well,
Absolutely.
Meredith. Very important. Mm-hmm. So we're getting sort of outside our comfort area with just professors at this point. And I think it's getting better.
Yep, it is getting better. And in the meantime, we might just drop something a little different, right, Sean? Let's work on something a little different.
I actually like this one.
Mm-hmm. We're cooking up a side episode on the AI apocalypse. Yes, the end of the world kind of stuff. Killer robots, recursive self-improvement, paperclip maximizers, like the classic sci-fi stuff. So it's just going to be a lot of fun.
We thought about this and we said, why not just have a fun one somewhere
Absolutely.
In the mix? Because we don't want to always be depressive.
Mm-mm.
So bottom line, subscribe, stay tuned, and keep your terms of service close. See you next time.
All right, see ya.